We certainly are living through challenging times for decision makers both in the private and public spheres. The past year, as Alan has said, has seen a major change in economic and financial conditions. Global growth, having been well above average for a string of years, has slowed, particularly in the major countries. Yet inflation remains a concern. Large losses have been incurred by international financial institutions and indeed several household names in investment banking have disappeared recently. Appetite for risk, which had been strong to the point of recklessness in some areas, has abated and has been replaced by risk aversion. Credit is harder to get and it's more expensive. Australia has been affected by these forces, but much less than the countries at the epicentre. And as Alan already said, our financial system is weathering the storm well. There is a storm, but we're weathering it well. Well, amidst all the excitement, even today's excitement, it still seems to me sensible on occasion to step back from the very high-frequency data and events that we spend our days thinking about and to focus on the bigger picture. And what I'd like to do today is to talk about four low-frequency, long-run themes that I think are important, though each of these nonetheless has been amply demonstrated one way or another in the events of the past year or two. Those themes are, firstly, the emergence of China, secondly, the economics of a fully employed economy, thirdly, the end, possibly, of the long period of households gearing up their balance sheets, and finally, shifting perspectives about the role and the regulation of the financial system in the economy. So let me begin with some remarks about China, and I'm not talking here about the notion of decoupling, so-called. I actually think that's an unhelpful term because nothing ever is actually decoupled. Everything really is connected. The thing is that the connections are complex and there are a lot of forces at work which operate in different directions. And so reasonable people will have differing opinions about how things will play out over the next year. I've got quite a wobbly lectern here. I hope that's not a sign of things to come. I'll just move it around, see if I can get a more stable foundation while I'm talking. But at present, I think China is actually slowing down, partly as a result of the US slowdown and the slowdown in Europe, and partly also by design. Now, policymakers there have been attempting some slowdown because of clear evidence of overheating in the Chinese economy, and they have, I think, achieved that to the point where they're now in the position earlier this week of being able to remove a little bit of that restraint in the past couple of days. But the long-term emergence of China as an industrialising economy is a fundamental change to the economic, financial and political landscape whose full consequences I suspect we cannot as yet appreciate fully. That's been happening, of course, for a couple of decades, but the way in which it has its effect has been shifting. For some years, China was too small to have all that much impact abroad. Even a country with a lot of people is economically small if their per capita income and productivity is very low, which it was in China for some time. Then, sometime in the 1990s, China became quantitatively important enough that we began to notice the effects of millions of Chinese workers becoming productive and putting manufactured products into the world economy. And so we enjoyed the disinflationary impact on prices of that effect. In more recent years, we've been experiencing another phenomenon of China's growth, namely the effect of rising Chinese living standards on the demand for raw materials and energy, as they seek, not surprisingly and understandably, to have a standard of living more like our own. Of course, that effect isn't confined to China. It's happening around the developing world, but China is obviously the biggest example of that phenomenon. Well, commodity prices are coming off their highs at the moment, though the key ones for Australia remain quite high still. Even if this marks a cyclical turn for these prices, longer term, it seems to me that this new claim on resources and energy out of China and other places won't go away. It's going to be a permanent feature of the landscape. Other countries, including ourselves, therefore, have to adjust to that, and we are doing so. And that adjustment can be, in some ways, difficult. Certainly the rise in prices for energy has made it harder for the rest of the world to combine steady growth and low inflation in the same way that we did from the mid-1990s until just a few years ago. So that's one adjustment that all countries elsewhere are undertaking. At the same time, this extraordinary increase in demand for raw materials has raised Australia's terms of trade by about two-thirds in the space of 5 years. I know I keep harping on this, but this is the biggest event of that kind in five decades or more. So for Australia, the economics of this episode are actually more complex than they are for the average industrialised country. Like others, in the energy-using parts of our economy, it's harder now to combine steady growth and low inflation as easily as we did from the mid-90s until recently. But on top of that, we've had to absorb a massive boost to national income. Now, of course, there are worse problems to have than having to absorb a massive boost to your income. I'd rather have that problem than some others I can think of. Nonetheless, that brings significant adjustments to the structure of the economy, to where the population lives, to how the national income is earned and distributed. Those adjustments are ongoing, and unless resource prices reverse a long way, those adjustments will continue in the period ahead. So the main point is China's emergence is far from complete. Like all economies, it will have a cycle, but its average growth rate is likely to be pretty high for a long time ahead, even if not quite as high as it's been just in the past couple of years. That's an opportunity and a challenge for Australia, for our business leaders and our policy makers, and probably not just in the resources sector. So that's my first theme. The second theme is the economics of full employment. It's a good thing we can even talk about that, actually, but over recent years, I think it's pretty clear that the Australian labour market has been as tight as anything for a generation. The rate of unemployment in the past year, at around 4%, has been as low as anything since 1974. In our surveys and discussions with firms, difficulty securing labour has been a very prominent theme for several years. The term capacity constraint has become a part of the Australian lexicon over recent years in a way we haven't seen for a long time. Survey measures of capacity utilisation have been very high. They're coming down a bit now, but they're actually, at this point, still fairly high. And fixed investment to increase capacity is of course, running at a high pace. So we've been pretty close to full employment. Let's be clear that that's a good thing. It's one of the objectives the Reserve Bank has, actually, in our act, in words that date since 1945. Although, interestingly, the authors of those words never defined numerically exactly what they meant by full employment, or for that matter by the term stability of the currency, which we take to mean controlling inflation. But leaving that aside, we have been more or less at full employment in recent times. The economics of full employment, though, are different to the economics of trying to get to full employment when you're below it. That's a simple point, but it's very important. When the economy has too much spare capacity, say in the aftermath of a business cycle downturn, The intention of policies is to grow demand quickly to catch up to potential supply. There may be several years, in fact, in which the growth of demand is faster than average while you eat up that spare capacity. But once that spare capacity has been wound in, the growth in demand and actual output has to slow down to match the growth in the supply potential that the economy has. That potential supply growth is given by the growth in the labour force, growth in the capital stock, and the growth in the productivity with which we deploy those factors of production. Typically, economists think of potential GDP growth in Australia as something like around 3%, give or take a bit in real terms. Well, this, as my predecessor Ian McFarlane remarked a few years ago, means that once these reserves of spare capacity have been used up, we should expect to be accustomed to growth rates for GDP starting with a 2 or a 3 before the decimal place, not the 4s and 5s that we saw over many years through the 1990s and in early part of this decade. There won't be many years like that anymore if we're starting from a position of pretty much full employment. Periods of growth above 3%, thereabouts, will probably be matched in duration and size by periods below 3, as we're having now. If we set our aspirations higher than that, if we try to grow above average all the time, we won't actually get much more growth, we'll just get inflation. So that's the economics of full employment. Now, you might feel that a growth rate of real GDP of 3%, give or take a bit, is not that high. It's actually pretty good compared with many in advanced countries, but you might feel perhaps that's a bit low. Could we raise it? Can we do better? Well, the only way we can do better isn't just by pumping up demand, it's by raising the rate of growth of potential supply. And we can do that by adding more factors, more labour, more capital, or we can raise the growth of productivity. And in the long run, that productivity one, I think, is the key one. And on that front, productivity growth in recent years does seem to have settled to a lower average pace than we saw through most of the 1990s and the early part of this decade. That may have several causes, and the experts debate those, but that is what the data seem to show. So over the years ahead, it seems to me as a community we must not let up on our efforts to foster as much growth in productivity as we can. Now, I haven't come with a list of specific policy prescriptions here, and indeed part of the problem in this area is that it's hard to be prescriptive in a very precise way. I think the general points, though, are that trying to sustain competition, to keep markets open, to maintain flexibility and all those things, which have been hallmarks of Australia's economic policies for many years now, are the key things. And it's important, I think, occasionally to articulate those themes. So that's my second theme, the economics of full employment. The third theme is household balance sheets, which of course have been a big feature of the past 15 years or so in many countries. In the early 1990s, gross household debt in Australia amounted to about 60% of annual income for the household sector as a whole. This year it reached 160%. Households' assets grew roughly in parallel with that, not quite as quickly, but almost as quickly. So total assets were 460% of income in 1990. They're now about 800%. They've come down a little bit this year with the fall in the share market and some softening in housing values. Debt to assets, or leverage if you like, has risen from about 10% in 1990 to about 18% now, which is not extraordinarily high by any means internationally. And the ratio of housing debt to housing assets has risen to about 27%. Well, very similar trends to that have been seen in a lot of countries around the world. So in thinking about why it occurred, it's very important not to look only for locally specific explanations. But in summary, the main factors behind that trend were, I think, firstly, a general tendency for assets and liabilities to rise faster than current income. That's a feature of all sophisticated economies and has been at least since World War II. That's long been a trend. Secondly, in the period in question, an increased pace of financial innovation, particularly the availability of credit to households, increased a lot around the world. Once upon a time, I think capital markets were seriously inaccessible for many households, but in the past 10 years, any household anywhere in the world who was credit worthy, and some who weren't, were able to get as much credit as they wanted. A third factor, which is quite important, is the decline in inflation, which took place in Australia in the early 90s and in other countries earlier than that. And the reason that's important is that it brought down nominal interest rates a lot, and for households in particular, it's the nominal rate that really matters because it drives the number of dollars you can pay out of your current income to service the liability. So that was a big factor, and of course a very welcome one. A fourth factor was that there was a pretty long period of quite low long-term interest rates globally. This is more a global factor than an Australia-specific one, but that did prompt a lot more borrowing, particularly in the US. And of course it wasn't the central banks that set those long rates, it was the markets. And without going into a long dissertation here, I do think myself that the build-up of saving in Asia, among other things, had a lot to do with that long-term interest rates being quite low. And then finally, there's been a desire, a normal desire, to devote a higher share of a rising income to housing services over time. As people's income increases, certain goods and services will assume a smaller proportion of their spending. Food, for example, or a lot of manufactured goods, clothing would be another, get smaller as a share of our consumption bundle as we get richer. And so-called superior goods, like health, for example, take a bigger share of our consumption bundle as we get more affluent. Housing, I think, in Australia at least, has tended to be in that class. Our aspirations in terms of position, quality, size of housing have increased as we've grown more affluent, naturally enough. But for various reasons, the supply is not elastic. There's only so much well-located land, and other factors have affected the supply price of dwellings. So in the end, we're devoting a higher share of our income to acquiring the services of housing, and we mainly do that by servicing larger mortgages. So all those factors have been at work pushing up household borrowing over the past probably nearly 20 years. A question, I think, is whether that long period of gearing up might be approaching an end. Certainly at the moment, household credit growth is much slower than it's been for some years. It's growing roughly in line with income, after many years of having grown much faster. Might we see this more conservative approach persist? Well, it's hard to know the answer to that question. Certainly, there's a lot more of the household balance sheet which could yet be collateralised, and plenty of innovative lenders, I guess, thinking about how to do that once the current turmoil passes. So gearing up might resume in due course. But there's also a chance, it seems to me, that households might seek to contain and consolidate debt for some time, that they may grow their consumer spending more in line with their income and save more of their current income than they have in the recent past. And it seems to me possible that we're witnessing the early part of such a phase. Time will tell. But if that is the case, then the growth opportunities for businesses and financial institutions in the years ahead will be a bit different to the ones we saw in the past 15 years. And whereas the household balance sheet was the big story from the mid-90s to now in many countries, some other financial trend is more likely to be the big trend in the next 10 years. What might that be? Well, I think there are some developments around suggesting that the balance sheet of governments is going to be asked to expand a good deal, certainly in the near term, as they support the finance sector in countries like the United States or the UK, and maybe one or two others. In Australia, we don't face that, though I suspect that the build-up in public infrastructure, which is planned and which is needed, may point to in the direction of government balance sheets expanding if the recent sudden aversion to those sorts of assets by private investors were to continue. Governments might then have to choose whether to fund more of those projects themselves or to defer them. Fortunately, public balance sheets in this country are in a very much stronger position than almost any other country you could name. Most governments would kill for a set of fiscal accounts like the ones we have. So that's the third theme, household balance sheets and how the future might look a bit different there. The final theme I'd like to talk briefly about is financial stability and regulation. Of course, we've just talked about all these issues surrounding the availability of the public sector's balance sheet to help out the financial sector, and even today, as you've no doubt read before you came here, there is a very large amount of support about to be extended by the United States authorities to AIG. We've also seen the actions by the US Treasury to take over the running of the entities known as Fannie and Freddie a week or so back. And as Secretary Paulson commented at the time, the ambiguity about who was bearing the risk in those entities has actually been a problem for years, and it needed to be resolved. So the US government has shouldered the responsibility that investors always assumed that it would, but has quite appropriately done that in a way which minimises the extent of bailout for private shareholders who were enjoying the profits in earlier years. Well, facing up to those problems where the entities concerned were de facto public, as Fannie and Freddie really were, or at least guaranteed by the government, that's one thing. The question of support, though, has also arisen for entities which have always been purely private and which at least hitherto have not explicitly been regarded as so systemically important, so central, that allowing them to fail would be very dangerous. The events of the past few days, of course, illustrate how difficult these issues have become. Without wanting to talk about that in any detail, all these cases, I think, show that in the final analysis there wasn't enough capital behind the risks that were being taken in these instruments by these institutions. The sophisticated financial system of the 21st century was supposed to manage risk and spread it around, but in fact, a lot of the risk ended up being concentrated on the books of highly leveraged institutions. High risk and high leverage proved to be a fatal combination. It always does. So I think some significant questions emerge from this, a whole host of them, in fact. But the main one that I want to focus on is the broadest and simplest one, which is whether something can and should be done to dampen the profound cycles in financial behaviour with associated swings in asset prices and credit, given the damage that they potentially can do to an economy. Actually, that debate's been going on for quite some years in official circles, and there are several points of view. One of them is that counter-cyclical regulatory responses using the power of the prudential regulator, bank supervisors and so on, should be taken to dampen the so-called financial accelerator. By the financial accelerator, I mean the process whereby confidence raises asset prices, which raises collateral values, which then allows people to borrow more, which pushes up asset prices again, and so on, until at some point the whole thing starts to go in reverse, and then there's a fall in asset values and a deleveraging, as is happening around the world at the present time. Well, use of prudential tools to work against that phenomenon would actually, I think, be a departure from the way prudential supervision has been done up to now, where the goal has been the soundness of individual institutions, and the supervisors have not been charged with the responsibility of managing the dynamics of stability for the system as a whole. So it would be a departure. And a counter view that's around is that it isn't really possible to do that with prudential tools for a host of reasons. Some of those have to do with tax and accounting rules. Another one is that some of the key players are outside the regulatory net, investment banks, for example, but also hedge funds and so on. So that view tends to hold that it probably won't work to just rely on prudential supervisory tools to handle this financial cycle, if you've decided that that's what you want to do, and that an effective response inevitably would involve using monetary policy. Now, that would mean raising interest rates in times of booming asset and credit markets, even though goods and services inflation remains low, in order to provide a stabilising influence over these swings in behaviour. I need some liquidity just here. Now, some people argue that you can reconcile that with standard inflation targeting, but only if the the time period for the target is quite long, a lot longer than it is for inflation targeting countries at present, or if the central bank is given a great deal of flexibility. So that's another view that has been around over the years. A third view is that it isn't possible, at least with policymakers' current knowledge, to know whether it's correct to lean against asset booms. In fact, it could be destabilising to try, and that actually is a respectable view, and there's some research in favour of that view. So on that view, what that view holds is that the only thing you can do is respond to the collapse, if and when it occurs, to try to protect the financial system and clean up the mess, so to speak. And that's tended to be the US official view, at least up to this point. That debate was quite active, actually, in this whole debate about what you do with these asset and credit swings was quite active following the collapse of the dot-com bubble in the early 2000s. Those in favour of more policy action on this front didn't get much traction, though, because I think mainly because the US economy recovered from that episode quite quickly. In fact, 2001 was quite a mild recession for them. I sense now, though, that among thoughtful people, this whole set of questions is once again coming up for grabs. And I'm not proposing to take a position in that debate today, merely to say that I think that debate is underway. It'll proceed over the next several years, and it will be fascinating to watch how it unfolds. But at this point, I won't keep you from your dessert any longer. Let me finish. In the barrage of information that we get every day, it's often hard to stand back and think about the big forces at work. But it is those forces, I think, and our responses to them that will shape the economic and financial environment over the long term more than the short-run financial news will. So hopefully, despite all the turmoil, we can all find some time to think about these issues. And it's in that spirit that I offer these remarks today. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Glenn. Thank you very much for sharing those perspectives. Now, The Governor has kindly agreed to take questions. We have quite a few media here today, and the way we normally do things at these lunches is we do take questions from the media, but towards the end of the question session, so there will be a specific opportunity. Now, those of you who would like to ask questions, can I ask that you signal by raising your hands, because then someone will bring you a microphone, and that is important. Yes, there's somebody there. That is important because this is being recorded, and the audio will be available. So, sorry, do we have a mic for somebody over there? Yeah, there we go.
Thank you. Governor Stephen Walters from JP Morgan. I note your reluctance to talk about short-term financial news, but I'm just wondering if you can perhaps tie together what's happening in markets and what the macro implications might be if I tie it into your first point about China in particular, and what perhaps the fallout from this macro event might be on Australia, given our terms of trade, which you again mentioned as a very important stimulus to the economy. And I note also that China has moved to ease policy, as you mentioned, but the Federal Reserve, of course, this morning did not. So I'm just interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, I'm not going to offer commentary on what the Fed did or didn't do, or my Chinese counterparts. The view that we have on China is, as I said earlier, and I think we've set this out in some of the recent publications as well, I think China is slowing down. They had to slow down, and they were trying to do so. Like anybody else, of course, they won't want to slow too much, and the Chinese authorities usual aspirations for GDP growth are, you know, a much bigger number than most of the rest of us would contemplate. They think 10 or 11 or 12 is too strong, but I think they'd probably think 6 or 7 is too low. So they are slowing. Our forecast for the terms of trade, which is sort of the summary statistic of all this for Australia on the trade connection front, is in the public domain in the SMP of a few weeks ago. I see no reason to change that forecast at this stage. And that forecast is that we've probably reached the peak and they'll come down a little bit. Now, that's a forecast that I think most of us who are in the forecasting business have been making for 5 years. We've been wrong every year so far, but Chris Caton always used to say, if you keep making a forecast long enough, eventually it will be right. So this may be a moment to take his advice.
Yes, okay. Question there.
Oh, thank you. Stefan Wisniewski, thank you very much, Mr. Stevens, for a very interesting outline of some of the longer-term issues. One of the things that's fascinating me is how do you deal with sort of a two-speed or even three-speed economy that we have in Australia as you think about things, whether it's by sectors or by geographies that actually have quite different economic characteristics and respond differently to policy. How do you deal with those kind of questions around the table when you do think about it?
Yeah, it's a question that has been asked a number of times over recent years, and it's a fair enough one because the terms of trade shock we were just talking about, in its initial impact at least, is not geographically or industrially even, obviously. That said, what we observe is that the effects do spread across the economy, though. And there are many mechanisms in the economy through which that occurs. My usual quip is miners buy Holdens. But the point is that the expansionary income effects that come to the mineral sector then find their way to other parts of the economy because that sector looks to expand its infrastructure, so construction gains. Everybody who's a consulting engineer or an explorer, or all these people, get stronger demand for their services. The income gains flow to shareholders, many of which some of them live abroad, of course, but many live around the rest of the country. So there are a lot of mechanisms that spread the impact around. The initial impact isn't even, But if you have the shock today and then look at the economy 3 years down the road, you usually will find that the effects have started to spread around reasonably promptly. And indeed, we track measures of dispersion of economic performance. And I think those measures probably are showing that dispersion is starting to increase again a bit now. But over recent years, on the whole, those measures of dispersion are not unusually wide compared with longer-run history. And I think the reason is that these effects do eventually spread around the economy. So that's the first point. Ultimately, we've got one instrument. Australia is a currency area. We have to set monetary policy for the country as a whole. Actually, there are minor differences in inflation performance across regions, but they're not very big. So at least the target variable isn't subject to all that many speeds by region. And that's all we can do. And it's up to the other mechanisms in the economy, some of which there are many, to kind of ameliorate some of these regional differences. There's one right over there.
Good afternoon, Scott Hawker from the Commonwealth Bank. Governor, thank you for the presentation. You commented on private balance sheets, personal balance sheets, and you talked about public balance sheets. I wonder if you would extend that thinking to corporate balance sheets. How well positioned is corporate Australia to cope with the winds of change that are coming through at the moment?
That's a good question. And I made some comments about this in my parliamentary evidence the other day. On the whole, as we see it, the balance sheet of corporate Australia are very strong. There are exceptions. There were some entities with high leverage and complexity, and those are the entities who are under pressure at the moment. And, you know, we all know who they are. For the vast bulk of the corporate sector, as best we can tell, balance sheets are in very strong shape. The corporate sector is quite liquid. And profitability generally is pretty good too. And therefore, maybe it's not that surprising that, at least as stated in the most recent capital expenditure survey data, investment intentions remain remarkably robust, I'd say. Given the other circumstances in the world. So I think with the exceptions of some parts of the business world that had complex and leveraged structures, and they're a minority, the rest of the corporate sector is actually in very good shape.
Not any financial thing. I think as yesterday I thought it was marvellous the way the Australian economy held up, even though that the Australian dollar fell down to 79 cents. And I was surprised in the fact that it has held up, that it did go so far, and it's over 20% since it's gone down. Now, just one thing on microeconomic performance. That has also gone off, and you mentioned that, that the economy, Australian economy, has started to slow. We need to do more on macroeconomic performance. And the other thing is that on savings, we don't do any savings, and that's where our government has come in and started the Australia Fund and then go on into household and education. But the main thing I think I want to ask you is why the Australian dollar has fallen as much as it has, considering as what happened yesterday, the Australian markets haven't fallen like the rest of the world have.
Well, I'll give a couple of comments, prefacing it by saying I normally try to avoid commenting on exchange rates because... if there's one variable which the economics fraternity is quite poor at forecasting, that's the one. I think when someone tells you why did something move that way, the only really honest answer is more sellers than buyers, which is usually not regarded as satisfactory to give your boss. But I think what we've seen, what we've seen over recent months is a few things. We've seen a change in expectations about interest rates in Australia. At the moment, the market is pricing considerable further easing by us. I have no comment today on whether or not that will occur, but that is what's priced in, and that must affect exchange rates. The world economy, I think, is now looking slower than it did some months ago. A number of countries have had quite a poor June quarter. I think a lot of that was due to the sharp surge in oil prices, actually. That's a common shock that many countries have experienced. But nonetheless, whatever the reason, global growth expectations are being revised down a bit, and so are expectations for many commodity prices, and our currency is usually affected by changes of sentiment there. And of course there are waves of risk aversion flowing across the world, and that also affects currencies, as it does all markets, and that's probably been a factor. Whether it's fallen as far as it should, I would not necessarily endorse any particular view about whether it's at the right level. I don't think that would be sensible, but you can at least directionally, I think, understand why it fell from the peak that it did in over that short period. Now, from here, well, I wouldn't want to speculate about these matters. It's not wise to do so. Next question. I'm getting my pads on, my straight bat ready for...
Well, we could take media questions.
Sure.
We can take questions from the media now.
I'll just pad up for this then.
I think there's somebody there who'd like a mic.
Governor Chris Maher from the Seven Network. We're being told by our politicians that the economy is going well, that we're weathering the storm. Australians may be surprised by this, that our relatively small economy is weathering the storm. How can they have confidence that that will remain the case, though?
Well, I think we can have confidence in the robustness of our banking system. That's, I think, a well-known fact. We've got good policy frameworks in place. We've got a pretty flexible economy. The floating exchange rate we were just talking about, whether or not we like or agree with particular movements, that's been a mechanism that, in the face of shocks in the past, has helped the economy adjust. So I think they're all strong fundamentals, and we do not have, and haven't ever had, the sorts of root problems in housing finance that the countries who are really in deep trouble have had. That's the fundamental difference. And I think that difference is as clear as night and day. So I think the facts and some confidence in our own abilities to hold our heads, keep our heads and be sensible, I think the facts support quiet confidence, not some kind of, over-the-top optimism, but some quiet confidence that the economy will cope well with the shocks we're facing. And I think that's the evidence we have so far. Next.
Richard Lindell from ABC Radio. Has the events of the last few days, the shocks to the financial system globally, given the Reserve Bank pause for thought in terms of global growth forecasts and monetary policy settings for Australia?
Well, I don't think I'm going to start commenting on forecast revisions or otherwise on the run in the midst of all these events. We've got a process that evaluates all this information in the lead up to the decision point, and that process will unfold in its normal way, and the board will make a sound and balanced decision at its next meeting and all the ones after that.
There's another question over there.
Yeah. Andrew Robertson from the Late Line Business Show at the ABC. Can I just follow up that question? And I hope you've still got your straight bat. I mean, when a time bomb comes at you out of left field, I mean, how much harder does it make your job?
When a what comes?
When something comes out of left field, like we've seen in the last few days, how much harder does it make the Reserve Bank's job, big events overseas that are going to have an impact here?
Well, shocks happen economic life. And when they come, you have to evaluate them and work out what they mean and craft your response accordingly, and that's always been true. These shocks are unusual ones, but if I think back to the past 10 or 15 years, we've had some other pretty big ones as well, and we've managed to find a way through them, and I think we can on this occasion as well.
Governor Stevens, Oscar Subrakti from SBS TV. In your speech, you raised the issue of full employment. So this is quite a new concept in the public sphere in terms of what they've heard over the last year. Can you explain if the unemployment rate continues to stay as it is, or if indeed drop, will you feel compelled to keep the cash rate as it is, or will you indeed rise it, or will it have no bearing on your decision?
Well, I don't think full employment as a concept ought to be a new one. I think we've actually been pretty much at full employment for a couple of years now, and that's an objective of economic policies after all. So I don't think it ought to be seen as novel. And I would not myself subscribe to the view that some particular path for the unemployment rate per se dictates any particular monetary policy action. We're not ideological about what some minimum rate of unemployment might be. We're pragmatic about that. What guides the decision is what are the prospects for inflation and overall economic performance over the period ahead, and what can we do to keep those things on track? That's the question we have to ask. And the labour market figures are one input into that question, but one among a whole host. So there's no particular, nor has there ever been, any particular linkage from a numerical unemployment rate to a particular interest rate decision.
John Keogh from the Financial Review. You just made the comment before that business investment remains remarkably robust, or in fact the expectations for it for fiscal 09, and indeed the minutes that were released this week also stated that, but there was also a hint there that maybe these expectations could be a little bit optimistic. Given the financial crisis overseas and also the slowing in the domestic economy, is it likely that maybe business will have to revisit those expectations, and how likely do you think that they'll be fulfilled?
Well, I imagine businesses are continually revising their plans. I think what I found remarkable about those data was that you would have expected a downward revision to occur in these figures. In fact, you got an upward one. Now, I can think of reasons why the most optimistic set of numbers there probably won't occur, and we would be actually assuming that the most optimistic expectation won't occur. But to me, what was remarkable was just how much confidence at least those businesses, and this is a sample of 5,000 firms, seem still to have in the outlook for their own companies and for the economic situation generally. And these data were taken in July and August. So they're not months out of date, they're quite recent. So it's a year into the global turmoil and at least 6 months into more subdued conditions at home. So that's why I found them quite striking. But I would imagine as time goes by, that not all those plans probably will come to pass. If they do, then the economy will be considerably stronger than we are currently forecasting.
Governor Stevens, it's Sue Lannan from ABC Radio. You said that the Australian financial system has weathered the financial turmoil well, but are you expecting more nasty shocks from Australian financial institutions? And were you surprised when you heard, say, the National Australia Bank announce provisions of more than $1 billion from debt-related investments in the US?
Well, they had those exposures and they had to disclose them and provision accordingly. That's their job. That's what their auditors would require them to do. So they did the right thing. But let's keep this in perspective. The Australian banking system, even in the cases where there have had to be some provisions or write-downs, we're talking about profits being slightly lower than they otherwise would be, but still very good profits, still ample capital, still ample access to funding, more expensive certainly, but this is light years away from what's happening in other banking systems around the world. If you draw the chart of Australian banking profits, compare that to the United States or Europe, you know, it's night and day. So the main point here is that these institutions remain very strong, and I think that will continue to be the case.
Jessica Irvine from the Sydney Morning Herald. Governor, I'm just wondering if you could tell us how the events of the last 2 weeks, and in particular the fall in global oil prices and also the financial shock, have affected your thinking as expressed in the latest board minutes between the risks between easing monetary policy too soon and easing it too late?
That's a very eloquent and subtle way of asking what are we going to do. it is your job to ask, Jessica. And it's my job not to tell you.